Welcome, everybody, to the Saints Hour. Mike Haas, along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. Hard to believe it is October 1st. October is here, yet we're still watching the daggone Weather Channel and what's happening out there with storms. So hopefully that will play itself out. So do you look at seasons in quarters? I know it's 17 games, but do you look still at seasons in four game stretches?
Yeah, I mean, we do. But I wouldn't, I think that's probably been over exaggerated a little bit in that, look, you're still playing 17 games, right? So you just got to play one game at a time and see where you stand and then move on to the next one. But I think, you know, when you sit here at the beginning of a month, you're looking at, hey, okay, who do we got this month? What do the next 4 weeks look like in terms of how the schedule is going to fit? And, you know, they're not always, you know, Sunday noon games. They're, you know, so the schedule can change where a team is at relative to its injuries and how they're playing. And so, yeah, I think we do look at it in quarters to some degree, but it's still, hey, who's the opponent this week? That's the mindset.
Right. No, I looked at it. These, for me, when this schedule came out, I was like, these first five are going to be, you know, whatever. It's a very tough opening. And then you look at from Atlanta week 10 to week 15 with Washington, that's four of your five at home. That's an interesting stretch. So I mean, I just kind of, I guess mine is just kind of based really a lot on kind of home in a way. So Dennis Allen said yesterday that, you know, spent Monday morning cleaning up the issues from the Atlanta game. And then by Monday afternoon, it's on to Kansas City. I mean, that's how fast it changes, right?
Yep, that's exactly how fast it changes. And we got to put that game to rest. Look, we had an opportunity to win it. We've had an opportunity to win the last two games and, you know, didn't make a play at the end to do that. That's how tough it is to win in the NFL. And yet, I felt like the Eagles game was a game that, man, they were playing really well. We were playing well. Somebody was going to steal a victory there, right? And we had our opportunity. I did feel like in this last game, we beat ourselves as much as anything with the two turnovers that led to scores. If you look at the game and you look at the numbers, you know, everything's in our favor. First downs, yardage, third downs, red zone, everything except the turnovers. And yet the turnovers and the points off turnovers are the most important stat in terms of winning and losing. And so we have to be conscious of that. And we've done a good job in that area in the first three games. And this one we didn't.
Right. And it's not something that you can go out, you know, tomorrow when they do start their walkthrough. It's like, you know, you got to work on this and that, and that you're always working on stuff. But it was a, you know, Rashid Shaheed. I mean, he would give anything to have it over. He didn't fumbled in 99 attempts, right? And it was just, you know, it wasn't his best. And he said he made a mistake. And then, you know, on the batted pass, that could have gone anywhere, right? And the fact that it lands in Anderson and he scores. So it's kind of not freak plays, but it's not like you can go out, oh, you've got to fix this and fix that. That's kind of the frustrating part about it.
Yeah, I think that, look, I think the thing there on both of those plays are, hey, the decisions that were made, right? The decision to field it was not a good decision. And Rashid would be the first one to say that. The decision to throw the ball after a double clutch, you know, by Derek, he would say, that was a bad decision. Should have did something else. Well, okay, look, those things happen. They do. But we can't have them happen again. You know, you have to learn from those and not, you know, that's what Dennis and our coaches, when they talk about making corrections, those are the corrections. Hey, we're not going to make that mistake in that circumstance, in that situation again. Let's live to have another play, so to speak. So it's not fun to lose. It's not fun to lose a game that you have in your grasp, which we have had both of these last two games, despite the mistakes that we've made and along with the things that we've done well. We had the chance to win both those games, late against, good teams, and we weren't able to get that done. We have to be able to close out those games, and that's what good teams do, and I believe we have a good team.
And this is not about the Rashid punt return. I'm just curious, as we've watched the NFL evolve in really the last 5, 7 years, and punters are getting so more effective at downing it inside the 10 or even the 5. And so they're, I want to say that you put your heels on the 8 or the 9, and that was your barometer from a kick return standpoint of whether you took it or not. Has that line changed because punters have, like, is that line now closer to the 5 or 6?
Well, I think it's definitely changed. And I think when I started, the line was the 10-yard line, and part of that was it was the old AstroTurf, so balls were going to bounce hard and generally bounce into the end zone. As we've gotten field turf and on grass, and the quality of it's just the different types of punts that these punters can do now. And it's basically like hitting a wedge and having it back up. They can do that. And so that, I think that line has gotten to the point where, we got heels on the 5-yard line oftentimes. And so it definitely has changed. Their skill level, the punters, has definitely increased, but there's still times when you choose not to field a punt, and you just got to be conscious of that.
When we come back, we'll have more with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. This is the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. We are talking with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis here on the Saints Hour. Mike Hoss and Mickey Loomis. And, injuries are such a huge part of this. And because of the longer week, your first injury report won't come out till Thursday. And I know Dennis and you guys aren't talking about it. I get it. But it's you look at how it is, how it impacts teams. San Francisco, the Rams, Kansas City loses their running back Pacheco, lose wide receiver Rashid Rice. So it's really, I guess, two things. You try, hope to stay as healthy as possible, and then how do you adjust when things don't go as planned? Because for the most part, they don't go as planned.
Yeah, I think, well, that's oftentimes dependent upon the type of injuries that you have and the quantity at a given position. So I think we're all conscious. Every team's conscious of injuries and having some depth, but man, you're limited. You're limited by roster size, you're limited by the salary cap, and let's just face it, if you lose a frontline player, the quality of guy or the experience of the guy that you're bringing in isn't the same. And so you have to make that difference up somehow. And it becomes more and more difficult if, you have multiple injuries in one position group. And it also becomes difficult sometimes, for example, if you have an injury that you have a definitive period that you know how long it's going to be. Okay, you can adjust to that. Let's just say it's, 6 weeks or 8 weeks. You can use your injured reserve. You can bring back a designated for return. So we have methods in order to adjust for that. But sometimes when you have an injury that might be week to week and you just don't know, it's more difficult to adjust because you don't have the same roster flexibility. So it's there's a lot of variables involved, is what I'm saying, Mike, and it makes it really difficult for any team, not just our team, but for any team to adjust to injuries.
And this is not in reference to anything that's going on with your team. This is just almost a generic question, but I was curious as to typically how tryouts and workouts would work for you. Is it an every other week or every week, or is it as needed? We have had a position get hit, or do you just, you are always looking? Do they happen, how often do they happen, tryouts?
I would say that, we're having a workout here probably on average once every 2 weeks. And look, oftentimes it's for something specific, and yet there may be just something that's anticipatory. If all of a sudden we're feeling, you know what, we're starting to get a little thin, or we have some concerns about a certain position group, let's bring in the guys that are out there. Let's see what kind of shape they're in. We mostly know them as players in terms of evaluating their playing ability. Oftentimes the workout is just to see what kind of condition they're in, or get a physical on a body part that maybe we have a concern about. So there's you know, there's different things that we're looking for in terms of the workout, but it's a constant process. I mean, we're always on the lookout for ways to improve our team, improve our depth, or have a resource to you know, to add in case we have an injury.
What is it like for your staff and yourself this week with an extra day? Dennis, they walk through tomorrow, and then basically Thursday becomes what Wednesday would have been, and you know, and so on. For your office, does anything change drastically?
Nah, not really. We just have an extra day in there, and so yeah, Thursday's going to be like a Wednesday for us, and Friday like a Thursday, and so on. So it doesn't really change much. It just adds an extra day in there, and a little more time to get a few more things done, actually.
Take a quick break. Come back. We'll be talking with Mickey Loomis, the Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager. We'll start to turn our attention towards Kansas City a little bit. We're back after this here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Welcome back to the Saints Hour. Mike Hulse along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. Monday Night Football, Kansas City Chiefs, only the 13th time that you've played them, 12 times previously. They lead the series 7-5. The last three games have been 3 points, 6 points, 3 points. The last time you were there was 2016. But it's, you know, kind of like the Superdome, right? Arrowhead, 1972. It's just it's one of those stadiums and one of those games. Their fan base is very passionate, like the Saints are. So it's, you know, you're there for a business trip, but it's a great kind of environment.
Well, it's number one, it's a great football town. They love the Chiefs. They're very passionate about it. They have a great fan base. You know, I was with Seattle for 15 years, and I don't have a lot of fond memories of Arrowhead. I think we won maybe one time when I was there, and the game we won, Derek Thomas had, I think, 7 or 8 sacks on our quarterback. And our quarterback ducked under the 9th one, last play of the game, and threw a ball like 45, 50 yards into the end zone. And we caught a touchdown to win. That was our only win there when I was in Seattle, in Kansas City. And it's just a tough environment to play in. And obviously, they've got a great team and a great coach, great quarterback. And, you know, we're going to have our hands full.
Later in the show, we're talking to Gary Barbaro. You know, played for Kansas City, and he was, when you mentioned that Seattle made me think that, you know, I was looking back through some of the, he was drafted in 1976, so that was Leroy Selman's, that was the expansion draft. It just, I'm a, you know,
right,
where generationally speaking, I was like, oh, so then Seattle was second, and he went in the third round of 76. The Saints that year took two running backs, Chuck Muncy and Tony Galbraith. So it's just, I don't know, I just go back to that, you think, it doesn't feel like that long ago, but you go 1976, Seattle and Tampa Bay when it coming into the league. So it's just time moves.
Well, I remember Gary well. And he's just absolutely the biggest human being to ever play safety. I swear. He's so big.
Yeah, 6'4".
Played that position. What a great athlete. Yeah. What a great athlete, you know, he is or was. And Gary's a good man.
So he played 7 years, 39 interceptions. So nearly 6 interceptions a year. And that is just, you know, that's stunning stuff.
Yeah, it is stunning stuff. Man, that I feel like that era of NFL football, the late 70s, 80s, man, there was a lot of great safeties in our league, you know, Ronnie Lott and Kenny Easley and Steve Atwater, and just, you know, a group of Gary, and there's other ones that I'm not naming, but there was just, that was a great era of safeties in the NFL.
So the Chiefs 4-0, two-time defending Super Bowl champs. And this is just kind of like, you know, the you guys have lost twice in just two games that could have easily won, could easily be 4-0. And if you look at Kansas City, they can easily be 0-4, for gosh sakes. They're 4-0, and it's kind of, they don't maybe always have their A game. Now, when you got number 15, you can, you know, you can right some wrongs, but they're I would suspect to you just one of those teams that finds a way. Maybe they don't play their best. They won 17-10 last week, but just they're kind of the epitome of figuring out a way to close.
I think, and we've been in this position before, where you have a team that you expect to win, right? And so when you expect to win, you know, and you have these adversities and these things that happen during the course of games, they become speed bumps that you have to, you know, get over. If you're hoping to win, then those speed bumps all of a sudden become mountains that you have to climb. And so, you know, we had a long period of time, you know, with Drew here where, man, we just expected to win. You expected to win every game. And when things didn't go well, well, we have ways to overcome those things. And certainly Kansas City is in that position. And that's a position we need to get ourselves into so that we can close out these games that we can't have a chance to win. And that's what they do. And so we have to, you have to be ready for that. You know, there's at no point should you ever feel comfortable, you know, playing against Kansas City, because you just said it, they find a way to overcome the adversities that happen to game in a game and find a way to win them.
And finally, on this, before we change segments, they do it really have, and then even in 23 with defense. I mean, it's all Mahomes and, you know, receiver, but it's been defense the last couple of years, this year and last year.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that happens when you have a great quarterback like Patrick Mahomes is that you tend to overlook the other parts of your team. And man, they play great defense. Steve Spagnuolo, who is a fantastic coach and a guy that I really admire, have a lot of respect for, and he has a lot of respect by everyone in our league, has done a fantastic job playing defense. And that's not easy, because I think teams, you know, generally when they're playing Kansas City, you're thinking, ah, we've got to score a lot of points, right? And so they're going to throw everything at him, and yet he finds a way to play great defense each week.
First, let's pause 10 seconds to let stations identify themselves here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. When we come back, we will talk with former NFL quarterback Jim Miller, who is now a co-host on Moving the Chains on Sirius XM with Pat Kerwin. That is next here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Welcome back to the Saints Hour. Mike Hoss, along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis, and we are joined by Jim Miller. He's the current co-host of Moving the Chains, along with Pat Kerwin on Sirius XM NFL Radio. Played professional football, Chicago, Pittsburgh, Michigan State, his college. He lives a little north of Detroit, still works for the Bears. So we know you like, I don't know, maybe you don't like cold weather, but you're certainly used to cold weather.
Yeah, the weather's going to start to change here. So luckily for the New Orleans Saints, they'll be playing in that dome. But hey, once you get north of the Mason-Dixon line, I'm going to be interested to see how the kickoff return rule now comes into play. That weather's going to turn at some point.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You know, I guess I would say that I'm a little surprised at how many touchbacks are being kicked. Now, we're a team that's, we're basically forcing the other team to return it. And we've had pretty good success at winning the field position battle on special teams by doing that. What's your take on, you know, what's your early reviews of that, of the dynamic kickoff, and what are your criticisms?
Yeah, I think, you know, like you said, I think if they would have moved it to the 35, you maybe would have had more of an opportunity, I think, where you wouldn't have as many touchbacks that are currently happening. But I do believe that. I've even talked to a coach in your division, Mickey Todd Bowles. He does think once the weather changes, I think you'll see some teams that have invested in their special teams via the draft or via their returners, that they will get more aggressive. You know, and I hate to say this, ego plays a part in this too, because special teams coaches that I've been with, hey, coach, we can get this guy. And I go back to the Super Bowl that between the Colts and the Bears. And here Tony Dungy elects to kick it to Devin Hester, and he returns that opening kickoff. So right. I do think there's ego involved. And special teams coaches, like you know well, Mickey, Mike Westhoff, I've talked to him numerous times out there in Denver. He's aggressive. He's got this dirty ball concept, and I do think it will play and factor in as the season goes along.
Yeah, I agree with you. Look, another thing I wanted to ask you about, Jim. Look, you were drafted 1994, was it? Yeah,
Yes.
1994, right? So training camp at that point was, 5 weeks long. It was, two a day practices. You had an off season. You had a lot of time as a young quarterback to get reps and develop and learn. Obviously it's not a quick process, but look, you've got time to development. You've got a lot of reps to get. What's your view of today? We have, 15 or 16 padded practices in a training camp now, and yet our expectations for these young quarterbacks are greater than ever. And yet, man, it's hard. Just talk about how hard it is to develop as a quarterback coming into the league.
All those, I agree with you, Mickey. All those reps are lost. I had the benefit of being drafted by the Steelers. Ron Earhart at that time was a longtime coordinator in the NFL. He had Super Bowls under his belt with the New York Giants, and he taught me well. I was under Neil O'Donnell. I was under Mike Tomczak. We not only had two-a-day practices where I got a lot of reps, but we also had scrimmages. We always scrimmaged the Buffalo Bills. We always scrimmaged the Washington Redskins at that point. So I went against Darryl Green. I was thrown in there. So I got not only the benefit of scrimmages where I got a lot of reps, then you had the four preseason games, not to mention two practices a day. So I was getting reps in the morning for run play action. I was getting reps in the afternoon for our shotgun offenses. I was thrown in goal line and short yardage in the scrimmages. Plus, I had four preseason games. That is a massive amount of reps that I got as a young player. And none of these young quarterbacks have been able to receive that. And I'll just give you Bryce Young, a quarterback in your division. He didn't even get the benefit of preseason reps in a game. I mean, how is situationally are you going to see him perform and evaluate if he's not even put in those situations in live game action? So, yeah, I agree with you. A lot is lost. A lot of development has been missed. And hopefully in the next CBA, it'll return a little bit. I'd like to see the quarterbacks meet more in the offseason.
Yep.
I wanted to
Yeah,
get your
I agree
go
with
ahead,
you
Mickey.
100%.
Jim, wanted to get your thoughts on the NFC South. I mean, I was in Irvine and listened to a lot of shows, and there was not a bulk of the time on a lot of shows, not your show, but just get given to the NFC South. Not a lot expected, but you see Tampa and you see the way the Saints have played, and in Atlanta as well, even Carolina with Bryce Young and Andy Dalton situation. Just your overall, what were your impressions pre-season, and have they changed?
Yeah, well, I think it's a very competitive division. I think last year was, other than the AFC, AFC North, it was one of the most competitive in the NFL. Because why? Every team in the NFC South has gone from worst to first. And now it kind of looks like an arms race with Tampa re-signing Baker, with obviously Mickey Loomis and the Saints going out and adding Derek Carr. And I think that makes the Saints a legitimate contender in the South. And then, of course, Atlanta. By signing Kirk Cousins, they've kind of gone all in with the quarterback spot. Andy Dalton obviously gives them a puncher's chance for Carolina. You'd see how that team is different and they'll be tough, but I think you're right. It's going to come down to the end, much like it always does. And it's going to come down to the division. Tampa Bay won it last year, but I think the Saints and Atlanta want to really chime in on that.
We are talking with,
Jim.
go ahead, Mickey.
Jim, one of the things that you and Pat did during training camp on your show was you had these ratings. You rated these position groups, which I thought was really interesting. And I didn't get to see or hear all of them, but I thought that was really interesting the way you guys did that. You awarded it was a point system, and then you ranked the position group relative to the rest of the league and relative to the division. It was really an interesting process that I enjoyed. Like I said, I wanted to know, look, what did you learn from that as you went through that? And did it change your opinion about certain teams and how they might, what the outlook for those teams were for this year?
Yeah, Mickey, it's been a great exercise for Pat and I because we always make our selections around Labor Day of who we think is going to be the division winner, who we think is going to be a wild card out of both the AFC in the NFC. And what this exercise does is it goes through for you to see objectively how strong is every room, meaning let's put a value number on each room, and then we can objectively see how strong a roster is on every single team, meaning that teams can fight through attrition and injuries. And I think every year it's helped Pat and I really pick our division winners. And it's been on point for about the last 5 years. Last year we had both Buffalo and Baltimore going to the AFC Championship game, for example, or say the San Francisco 49ers. So it gives us an idea how well built a roster is, and certainly general managers, how aggressive they are through free agency, through extensions, through all these things to build their team to get through 6 months of a grind of a season.
Yeah, it was look, I liked it because what you just said, you're taking into account. Look, it's easy to look at a team's number one and number two receiver and say, man, they're really good. But the fact of the matter is, most of the time, you're not going to have your number one and number two receiver for every game. And so who's the next guy and the next guys that are up at each position? Because that's going to dictate a lot of times how you perform during the middle of the season and at the end of the season. So it was really good process you guys came up with.
I love doing it. It really gives us a good heartbeat of the league overall.
We are talking with former NFL quarterback Jim Miller, also on SiriusXM, Moving the Chains with Pat Kirwan. And just overall, from an analyst situation, this in the 16-game season, the four-game would be our kind of the 25% measuring stick, but now it's 17, but still do it. But kind of biggest, your overall biggest either surprises, positive or negative, just through these first four games.
Well, I think you got to look at what Jaden Daniels has done for the Washington Commanders. I mean, that just looks like a perfect marriage with Cliff Kingsbury and how that offense is performing right now. Minnesota, I think, has got to be a team that is surprising the way Sam Darnold has played. I do think up until last night, Buffalo Bills, or this past week, I should say, the Buffalo Bills looked pretty strong, but then they kind of looked mortal this weekend against the Baltimore Ravens. And I do think Baltimore will start to exert itself. You know, a lot of these divisions are going to start to cannibalize each other. And a lot of it doesn't happen until after week 11, believe it or not.
Well, Jim, thank you. I really appreciate you being on. Look forward to talking to you and Pat sometime soon.
Mike, Mickey, good. Thanks for having me, and good luck the rest of the way, Mick.
Thank you as well, Mickey. Good luck next week in Kansas City, and we'll be talking soon, of course. When we come back, I'll be speaking with Gary Barbaro, New Orleans native, former defensive back for Nicholls State, as well as the Kansas City Chiefs, where he is now in the Chiefs Hall of Fame. That's next here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Welcome back to the Saints Hour. Mike Hoss joined now by Gary Barbaro, former defensive back for the Kansas City Chiefs, also works here in New Orleans, New Orleans native, went to East Jefferson, Nicholls State. He is a part of the NFL who is a inspector for NFL uniforms. We'll get to that in a little bit. How you doing, Gary?
I'm doing well.
That was a lot to unpack, but
Exactly.
impressive as well. So, drafted by Kansas City back in 1976, again, East Jefferson, where if I got it right, you played more musical instruments than football at EJ, correct?
That is correct. I was in a marching band, stage band, concert band. Only played varsity my senior year. Played football and baseball.
And as luck would have things, you go to Nicholls State. They had just started football. You were quarterback, but you got hurt, moved you to defensive back. Probably the best injury you ever had.
Well, without a doubt. Well, just the fact that I was at Nicholls State, them starting a program, they were looking for bodies. You know, they weren't going to get any blue chip athletes because, you know, starting a first year program, they just needed bodies to put on the field. And I was fortunate enough to start out with that program and could grow with it.
And became the first player in Nicholls State history to be get drafted into the NFL. And so you go to Kansas City, and the numbers. So first of all, let's get back to 1976. So that draft, I'm old, and so this brings back so much for me. So it's the draft in 76 is Leroy Selmon, Tampa Bay. This is the Tampa Seattle first picks. because of the expansion teams. The Saints went hard running back. Chuck Muncy with a third pick in the first round. Tony Galbraith with their second round pick. So they go two running backs in 1976. You go to Kansas City. You had 39 interceptions in 7 years, almost six interceptions a year. That is unbelievable stuff. What was that transition like from Nickel State to the NFL?
Big step. As you well know, when you go from high school to college, there's a big step there. And then when you go from college to the NFL, it's unimaginable how big that step is. I was fortunate enough to have players like Emmett Thomas and Willie Lanier still playing with the Chiefs when I got there. And obviously being the seasoned veterans and, you know, Hall of Famers that they are, they kind of took me under their wing and helped me along because, you know, as we talked about, you know, I started Nichols, their first program, and in 4 years, we went from a fledgling program to actually winning the Gulf South Conference my senior year. But not having anybody have previously gone to the NFL from Nichols, really didn't know what to expect. So I was thankful that I had those kind of guys to lean on.
I want to go back to the 1977 game. That's the day that you picked off Jim Zorn in the end zone, returned it 102 yards for a touchdown. At the time, it broke an NFL record. Still, I believe, the Chiefs' single-game record. That must have – I mean, 100 yards, if anybody hasn't done it, is a hard thing to do at full speed. But back in that – I'll be honest, I have not seen it. I was just reading about it. Was it contested, or was it just erased from the other goal line? And did it seem like it was a mile away?
It definitely seemed like a mile and a half away. And it was one of those cold days in Kansas City. So as you're running, and if you've ever run in the cold and you're running as fast as you can, your lungs are about to explode just from the cold weather. But the way that play had developed, they were down inside our 5 yard line and ran a fake dive play and tried to hit the tight end as he leaked out. And fortunately, we'd worked on that play several times during the week, and I was just fortunate enough to be able to step in front of it, and then it was just a race to the other end zone.
And several Pro Bowls, and you went into the Kansas City Chiefs Hall of Fame by Mr. Hunt. That must have, I think, 2012 or 2013. I'm not sure of the year, but I know I'm close. That must have been an enormously significant day for you.
Oh, without a doubt. 2013, they inducted me, and it was, you know, something that, you know, you always hope for, but you never know what'll happen. And, fortunately, I was inducted, and I can't say enough about how the Chiefs organization treated me and basically my entourage that went up to Kansas City to, you know, enjoy that that induction. Quite a weekend, a great honor.
Similar fan bases, at least in my head. I've only been to Arrowhead once, which is now GEHA Field at Arrowhead Stadium. And it was a long, long time ago, but it's just the fan bases to me are so passionate. They're, you know, Arrowhead opened up in 1972. So it's actually 3 years older than the Superdome here. So just iconic buildings. They're trying to figure out their future from a building standpoint. We, of course, just had our renovation come to a close. And so we can't wait to show this building off. But I mean, it is a very passionate fan base in Kansas City for the Hoodats that'll be up there on Monday night. And that's the other thing. Monday night football, they're 4-0. Every week it feels like they play on the national game, or Thursday or Sunday night or Monday night. But it's going to be a unique experience.
Without a doubt. And that stadium and that athletic complex is quite neat, because you've got the Royal Stadium and Arrowhead Stadium side by side there. So it's a real, really nice complex. And they've done some upgrades in the recent past here, upgrading both, I know, Arrowhead Stadium, and did some really nice things with their Hall of Fame, where they've got all of the statues displayed and a lot of information about all players. So yeah, I think the fans will really enjoy it. The fan base there has always been very supportive. Even, you know, the early years when I was there, we were a struggling team, but we still had decent support. And obviously now that, you know, the Chiefs are, you know, winning the Super Bowls, that fan base is just crazy.
It will be a electric experience. And as you watch so many games, and certainly because of your role with the NFL in the Superdome, and you just look at this game, that is it just feels like it changes by leaps and bounds, not, you know, not by decade anymore, by year to year. And you see, because you've seen it from, you know, the 70s on through, what strikes you as you're watching games today from the field or wherever you are? And I know a lot of it is on the field, and I know what that experience is like. What strikes you as to the difference that the game today presents?
Well, when I came into the league back in 76, it was more of a 3 yards and a cloud of dust. And they were just starting to open up the offense. Air Coryell with San Diego at the time was, you know, starting to do the multiple offenses. So that's been the biggest change with now it's pass first and run second, pretty much what you see. And some of the innovations that they've done on offense is tremendous. Some of the changes rule-wise as far as making contact with receivers and running backs, it's changed a lot. Back when I was playing, you know, my contact was as soon as the ball touched you, I touched you as hard as I possibly could. But now it seems like, you know, I'm all for player safety, but it still is a collision sport, and they've taken some of that out of it, I think. It's obviously, I understand, for player safety.
But it is such the speed of everybody, defensive tackles, right? I mean, the speed of the individual athlete to me is so, and you don't get the best measurement by watching it on television. It is, you almost have to see it in person. And if you're lucky enough to see it anywhere near the field, the collisions that happen out there are just jarring. It's probably the way I would explain it.
Absolutely. And, you know, like we were talking about the jump from college to the NFL, that's one of the big things you really notice is you've got a lot of fast players in college. But when you get to the pros, they're all fast. And I agree with you. It seems like they've even got bigger and faster in the, you know, most recent years here. So, yeah, that speed of that game is phenomenal.
I saw a picture from one of your Pro Bowls. I think you went to 80, 81, and 82. And that was, you were in the AFC Pro Bowl, and you had one of those like white foam neck braces that we would see, you know, back in that day. And it's just, you know, it's like almost like a defensive lineman linebacker, but I mean, you know, defensive back. It's just a different game. It just is. And I don't know. There's no question here. It's just a different game.
It is a different game. You know, one of those had that horse collar, that what they used to call that. And I was not afraid to stick my head into the pile. And sometimes you go, whoa, that was a bad decision, but, you know, it is what it is.
So how long, and people maybe didn't know this exists, you are a uniform inspector for the Saints home games, and you work for the NFL, correct?
That is correct. I work for the NFL.
And another man with you. I cannot think of his name right now.
Nate Singleton.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. He's a
tremendous guy.
Yeah, really super guy. Nate. And so I've you know, been around that press box for 35 years and on the field. And so take me, first of all, how does one get that job? And what does that job entail? Take fans through what a typical, you know, Saints home game.
Well, first off, how I got the job, a gentleman named Ed Reynolds worked with the NFL corporate office. And they were, and this is about 20, at least 25, 26 years ago, they came up with the idea of incorporating former players to do the on-field inspections and figured that players would relate better to a player than somebody from the organization telling them how to wear the uniform. So when I get the phone call, Ed Reynolds is telling me, you know, what they're looking to do, how they're going to do it. And it sounded really good. And I said, can I ask you a question? He goes, yeah, what is it? I said, who put you up to this? Because I thought it was a joke. So he said, no, this is real. Call it, you know, Players Association. It's a legit job. So I'm glad it was. So what we do as inspectors, we are on the field when the players come out for pregame. And they're supposed to be dressed in game attire, which really never happens much. But we actually give them written reports after the pregame, at the end of the first quarter and going into halftime, written reports saying, you know, so-and-so's either their socks are not pulled up, their jersey's out, they've got an illegal logo on. So we try and make sure that they wear the uniform that they're supposed to and wear it properly.
Does that get changed? Like if they're out for pregame and you guys see a glaring error, is that relayed to the team that game, like make a change, or did he get the fine or something later?
No, that happens during the game. So after pregame, I give it to the equipment manager. Both equipment managers get a report, actually a written report, with the player's number and the violations that we see for that particular player and all the players listed. And when they come back out for kickoff, we're checking to make sure that they've cleaned up and, you know, those are proper. And then we also look for the guys who didn't have a violation who have changed and now have a violation. So it's just an ongoing process. But we do it, like I said, after pregame. We do it. I talk to them at end of the first quarter and give them another written report going into the halftime.
Where does the shirt tail come into this from an NFL standpoint? I mean, they're almost so short they can't get tucked in, but there doesn't look like there's ever a plan to tuck them in. Most guys wear colored undershirts like Atlanta and black and red. So, I mean, where does the shirt tail come into this?
Well, and that has changed over the recent past. It used to be the jersey had to be tucked in, and any undergarment that was hanging out was a violation. Now they've got it to the point where the undergarment or the jersey can hang out. But if you look at the pants, NFL pants, they've got a NFL shield on one side and they've got a Nike logo on the other. If that's not covered up, then as long as that undergarment doesn't cover that, they're not in violation.
So you don't have to give me the player. That's not important. I'm curious as to what was the most egregious thing you've seen in all of your years now, like, oh my gosh, like what was the worst thing you had to kind of take care of?
Well, this actually, we almost pulled a player off the field. This was Frank Gore back when he was with the 49ers. And he used to come out and his pants were like biker shorts. So his pants were well above the knee. Well, the league says that the pants have to touch the knee and the game sock has to come up to touch the pants so there's no skin shown. And I had warned him a couple of times, in pregame, first quarter, he comes back out. So I actually take a photograph, send it up to the league office, and ask for a response, and they go, pull him off the field. I go, okay. So now I've got to go down, get the equipment manager. And fortunately, there was a timeout. But if I had to get the referee involved, then there was going to be a timeout call, there was going to be a penalty assessed, and it was going to get ugly. But I actually came that close to pulling the player off the field.
Wow. But typically it's fines, right? And it's based on their, whatever their game check may be, right? I mean, they decide, I'm going to pay the fine or not pay the fine or go change my uniform.
Exactly. And what we do is we try and let them know that if they clean these violations up, there's not going to be a problem. But if they don't, the league's could talk to them. So we don't assess fines. We're trying to eliminate them, but it's up to the player if they want to change it or not.
Gary Barbaro, we appreciate your time, my friend. Look forward to seeing you in the press box and Saints after Kansas City, of course, home for two, Tampa Bay, and then Sean Payton's return on Thursday night. Continued success, and I appreciate your time with us today.
Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it.
And that's our show for tonight. My thanks to Charlie Long in the booth, and my thanks to all of the Saints fans out there. We will speak to you next time here on the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network.